Shortly before the Teaching with Articles workshop launched, I wrote a blog post titled, Give Me a Number. And I was shocked to see the day after that article went out that I had an email from Mike Schmoker in my inbox saying basically, hey, I agree with you. I wanted to say, Mike, thanks for knowing that I exist. But instead I said, hey, Mike, would you be willing to give 30 minutes of your time to talk about issues around teaching with articles? He graciously agreed. The results of that are this conversation. Let's take a look. Dr. Mike Schmoker, a name that if you've been reading my blog for long, you've read many times. I hope that you've even read Dr. Schmoker's book, Focus, because I talk about it all the time, and it's been hugely influential in my own life, as any longtime reader can attest to. Dr. Schmoker is with us today from Tempe, Arizona, where the temperature is in the 90s right now, a stark difference from the 20s that I'm experiencing in Michigan. If you haven't heard of Dr. Schmoker's work, let me just share a bit of biographical information. Dr. Mike Schmoker is a former administrator, English teacher, and football coach. He has written 6 books and dozens of articles for educational journals, newspapers, and even for Time magazine. His most recent book that you've probably read is the best-selling Focus, Elevating the Essentials to Radically Improve Student Learning. His previous bestseller is Results Now, which was a finalist for Book of the Year by the Association of Education Publishers. Recently, just within the past couple of weeks, Dr. Schmoker released his latest book, Leading with Focus, Elevating the Essentials for School and District Improvement. That book would make a great gift for your administrator or superintendent. Dr. Schmoker is the 2014 recipient of the Distinguished Service Award by the National Association of Secondary School Principals for his publications and presentations. He has consulted and keynoted throughout the U.S., Canada, Australia, China, and Jordan. And he now lives in Tempe, Arizona, like I said, with his wife, Cheryl. Mike, thank you so much for being in this interview.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thank you, David.
Mike, let's just begin with first a personal question. Can you fill in some personal texture to that biographical piece of information there? Maybe things that you enjoy doing with your wife, Cheryl?
Well, I met Cheryl, my wife, in high school. We were both at Lake Havasu City High School, the American home for the London Bridge, for those of you who don't know that.
Okay.
And we married several years after a few years after we got out of college. We sort of met thereafter and had 2 wonderful children. And aside from being pretty obsessive parents, Cheryl and I enjoy walking, hiking together, do quite a bit of that, and we recommend things we read to each other, and we discuss things we read together, and that's a great connector for us.
Well, I can picture you guys doing some great hiking down there in the beautiful Arizona nature. I imagine there's a lot of great hiking near you.
Even here in the Phoenix metropolitan area, there's some fabulous hiking. You hardly feel like you're in the city. It's great.
Well, Mike, would you mind sharing with us a moment in time in your career in education of what you consider one of your worst episodes as an educator? And just tell us that story to help us get to know a little bit more about you and your work.
Well, there are a few in a very general way, and then I'll share just one in particular, but in a very general way, the tough thing was being an administrator in a couple of different districts and seeing that just the general culture of schooling does not favor a focus on the things that matter the most. The most frustrating things to be among either the only person or among very few who would love to call attention to opportunities within the school that could make an immediate, huge difference for students. But so much of what else goes on in a school, mandates, the sort of accumulation of tasks and traditions in schools prevent us from focusing on the things that could make schooling so much richer, more enjoyable, and productive for kids. In a general way, that is very disheartening, you know, at this point, late in my career. But if I had to go back to a certain moment that was depressing, it would have to be my student teaching, where I went from being a really happy English major at Northern Arizona University with great professors, and going into student teaching and discovering that everything good that I learned from my best professors in college, reading books, talking about them, how to write, how to explore ideas, dare I say, none of that seemed to matter. Let's have the students complete enormous packets with a variety of activities in them, which included, and this is for secondary, even high school,
sure,
which included coloring the characters and stories, doing word searches, crossword puzzles. There was more emphasis on how to make a great bulletin board with the elements of fiction on it, all that nonsense. Another thing I'm not wild about. That was what I was expected to do in student teaching, and it truly created enormous friction between myself and the two cooperating teachers I had to work with. I had to redo my student teaching. Fortunately, with the advocacy and support of my some of my professors, who said, you've got to find a place where this kid can just help students to learn how to read and talk about what they read and write. And I found a couple of teachers who didn't do those things themselves, but they were happy to let me redo about half of my student teaching as a kind of rerun. And so, yeah, that was a dark, disturbing moment.
Oh, that's a fantastic story, Mike. I can imagine that some student teachers listening here who are struggling and just being so encouraged by the fact that, you know, you went through this really intense situation. Wow. Thank you. It's so funny to hear you say too, like, find a teacher who just wanted kids to read and talk about what they're reading and write about that. Like the search was on.
It's just too obvious, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. Okay. Okay. Mike, now take us to a moment of an incredible aha. You know, those times that we all love as educators, things we love to create in our students. But when was a moment where you had an aha moment in your career? Tell us the story of that.
Well, you know, I have to go back in preparing for this and thinking about these questions you might ask. I have to go back to that initial student teaching where, oh gosh, against all odds, I managed to get these students to read three novels by Dickens. It was like a special class on Dickens, something you rarely find in high school. But they did have it in place, and I had them read all three books, and all I did was teach them to do was take a few notes, underline, annotate if it was their own book, and then taught them how to participate in a discussion by citing textual evidence. Now, realize this is all in the middle 70s, mind you.
Sure.
And I taught them a lot of vocabulary. Once they had the vocabulary, they would do the reading. I would teach them how to do the reading and then how to participate in a discussion and to clarify their thoughts. All, of course, in a way, as preparation for writing something like a college-style essay of, say, 3 pages, give or take, in length. And the amazing thing about my student teaching was that even though my lead cooperating teacher gave me something like a C, which is the equivalent of an F, he said, you teach like a college, teach as though these are college classes. That was his comment on my evaluation. The students wrote me a letter. If I may be so, if I can share this, they wrote me a letter. Almost all of them signed it. And they just said it was a great class. And they used as many of the vocabulary words as they could from the Dickens reading they had been doing and told me how much they had learned about engaging in discussions and writing. And that was when I realized, and you talk about aha, I realized in order to do the right thing, I may have to really swim upstream against and athwart precisely what people in the sort of educational establishment want me to do. That was the moment I thought, I'm going to have to fight this fight or compromise. And I was able to make my own way, and I'm happy that that occurred.
Well, I think what's amazing about your story is that, you know, you're talking about this being in the 1970s, but in 2016, I still see young people in my classroom, ninth graders, who are just so hungry and so eager to be taken seriously enough to be given just very simple, challenging, authentic literacy experiences again and again and again and again and again. It's basically what all my classes boil down to.
Yeah.
Not a lot has changed in some ways.
No, it hasn't. It really hasn't. I don't think we're much different now than we were in the 70s. The worst aspects of those trends away from what we would call it authentic literacy, I don't know what else to call it, it began in the 60s. And it's still with us today, the silly stuff.
Okay, well, I think we'll get into authentic literacy a bit more here with our next question. So your book focus, and by the way, for the listeners, there'll be links to Mike's books and anything else that we mention below this interview, so check those out. But Focus has been one of the pivotal books in my career, as I was sharing with you before the interview. Listeners may be interested to know that I was reading Mike's book as I was in my first year of blogging, and I actually decided the first full school year, 2012-2013, the first full school year in which I was blogging, I decided that I was only going to read one book all year, and I was going to reread it, and only one, because up until then I had had a case of the, you know, how many books can you read in a year, itis. And so Focus was that book. So if what Mike is sharing is kind of resonating or sounding familiar, it's because my thinking's been heavily shaped by it. But I want to get into the three pieces, Mike, in Focus that you say are essential if we're going to improve student learning throughout our schools. What are the three essential pieces that schools ought to be focusing on to get the best results possible?
Well, I'll be as succinct as I can be. Starting with curriculum, I always think of Edie Hirsch and Linda Darlingham. Two things. One, Edie Hirsch basically says, for us to learn adequately, we have to acquire and work from a knowledge base. The more we know, the more knowledge we acquire, the easier it is for us to acquire more knowledge, especially in the form of reading, vocabulary, a sense of the world, just our ability to pick up a text and know enough about what is already in that text to be able to pick up what we don't already know. Hirsch has done terrific work demonstrating that. He also points out that we have not had anything like common curriculum for over 60 years, well over 60 years, because teachers have just kind of defaulted to teaching whatever they like. Schools haven't required much of anything in a very common way. What we don't have is what Marzano would call a guaranteed curriculum. Any parent could know, if I send my child to school, I can know that whether they get Schmoker or Stewart for a teacher, there's certain essential things they will learn. There might be differences. We can handle that. But certain important things will be taught in each grade level where there's a kind of a build-up and an accumulation of essential knowledge. That is so important in so many ways. I just think of Rick DeFore. Rick DeFore will be the first to say, if you don't have that in place, you really can't have PLCs. You can't really work with another teacher to perfect your teaching, both what you teach or how you teach, until that's in place. And thirdly, I think of Darling Hammond, who says, until a teacher is given a coherent curriculum where they don't have to put all of it together all by themselves, they can't teach near as effectively. For a variety of reasons, these and more, curriculum is about as important and foundational as anything we know of. And for what it's worth, Marzano found it to be at least arguably, according to his meta-analyses, maybe the single largest factor in what accounts for academic learning and academic gain. So there's number one, curriculum, common, coherent, guaranteed curriculum, a very big deal. Now, number two would be literacy, and literacy needs to be built right into, or authentic literacy, needs to be built right into that curriculum. And we've already talked a little bit about this. The name of the game, and I know I'm being kind of brief, every student ought to be able to, and say, just for fun, by the end of fifth grade, the kinds of experiences a kid has in the first or kindergarten grade ought to equip that student to be able to pick up a challenging, substantive novel, read it, form their own opinions, make their own inferences about what they think about the characters, the message of that novel or poem. Agree or disagree with an essay or two different opposing essays, and be able to talk intelligently. As a fifth grader, as an intelligent fifth grader, about what they think about what they encountered in that text, they ought to be able to read it, talk about it, and then write something that's, say, a few pages in length that makes a few coherent points clearly and substantially with multiple references to the text. That's the kind of work we want students to be doing and producing throughout K-12. And it ought to get better and better as we move from elementary to middle and high school. To the point, I know this is not kind of funny, I think every student ought to graduate from high school literate enough to be about as literate as an awful lot of current college grads are. Because that could happen if we redirected time spent, especially in English and social studies classes. We redirected the time currently spent in those two. We could make that happen. Third and last, I'm a great believer in explicit instruction, and I will be brief here too. Just to say, if we don't make the purpose of the lesson quite clear to students, clear to them from the beginning to the end of the lesson, if we don't take them through simple, small steps, and between each step, give them opportunities to try or practice with what we just taught, during which time we check for understanding, walk around, circulate, seeing how well they're doing, and then reteach or adjust the pace of our instruction so that all students keep up with the pace of the lesson throughout by repeating that simple cycle. If we don't do that, we lose out on what many researchers say is perhaps the largest factor that rivals literacy, that rivals curriculum. It may be as large a factor as those two, and it's one of the keys to making sure that we teach well, that we teach successfully. And if I may add this last point, neither it nor any of the three things I just summarized, not so briefly after all, none of them is common or prevalent in current classrooms, and that's an awful shame.
Well, Mike, first of all, don't worry about brevity on my end, because I know that I'm sitting here and everyone listening is just saying, keep going. So don't worry about that from our perspective. I think that so the Guaranteed Viable Curriculum, authentic literacy experiences, explicit instruction, these are things that I think when we are receiving 1,000 different stimuli of tasks that we must do as educators, these things could quickly just sound like, okay, one more abstract thing or something. Let's narrow in on authentic literacy experience. Mm-hmm. And just for the sake of time, let me just say again, in focus, Mike gives numerous specific examples, Mike, you mentioned what a fifth grader could be able to do. In the book, you share the story of Rafe Esquith. You share multiple different schools across the grade levels in the book. So this is not at all theory. at all. And I just I need to emphasize that, because I know that even the most well-meaning educator can just tune things out that are important, and that's what we have to not do with these three pieces. So let's look at let's imagine, Mike, if you could just paint us a picture of what, or I mean, you don't have to paint. You can just tell us explicitly what could an authentic literacy style lesson, okay, a lesson with purposeful reading and writing, what could that look like in a secondary science class, a secondary social studies class, and a secondary ELA class? You can go grade specific if you want or not, but the audience here will be mostly secondary folks. So just give us an example of what that would look like.
Sure. I mean, in English, and they all overlap, and they're all very similar with perhaps some minor distinctions. I mean, in an English class, you would literally show students how you would read a poem line by line, thinking out loud, then giving them a chance to read another poem, or maybe just the next few lines in a poem, or the next few pages in a novel after you've read out loud, stopped, either underlined or taken a note and told students, thought out loud with them to say, you know, this is what goes through my mind. When I read this, I get this impression of this character. It causes me to find that character to be interesting or likable or loathsome. And I begin to form an opinion about that character. I begin to get a sense of maybe what the message of the book might be. We should be doing that with virtually every reading assignment. Now, in social studies, you might be reading about the Gilded Age, and you would show, again, you would model for students how you would read the first few sentences or paragraph in a two-page or three-page treatment of the Gilded Age, and you would give them a sense of the sorts of things they should be looking for. A lot of the time, what they're looking for is going to be governed by a good question, like, what do you think of? What do you think of the major players and historical figures in the Gilded Age? Do you think that what they did, for instance, for the country was good or bad or fair or understandable? And show them how you would do that kind of reading and thinking and note-taking. After showing them how to do that, once they master that, and they will, you know, I've had students master kind of the rudiments of reading and note taking and underlining and annotating in a single class period, and they're rolling. Then you teach them similarly how to engage in a discussion, how to look at their notes, their underlinings. Maybe after they pair up and try their opinions out on each other, how to introduce their remarks. How to disagree with each other, or add to or amplify on each other's remarks in a civil, clear way. And I would just throw this in on science. I always think it's interesting. One of my favorite people in literacy is a guy named Timothy Shanahan, who writes, each discipline has its own way of reading, certain distinct ways of reading, and one of the things most of my audience is aware of once we get to talking about it is that when your students need to be shown how, we need to model for students how, when you're reading science text, they don't know this, we think it's natural, it's not, how you have to read typically very short sections, just a few sentences, sometimes multiple times because it's such dense text. Same with math. And then turn toward an illustration or a graph and then come back to that text in order for it to make more sense to you. That sort of reciprocal movement between text and illustration, text and graph, text and diagram, text and equation is something we need to teach explicitly in math and science text. But all text, I think most things, the first go-around, need to be taught explicitly. That's the big lesson for us, even perhaps especially in literacy.
Well, and I love that, because what you just go through here in this explanation helps to hopefully cement for the listener that those three strategic pieces, curricula, literacy, explicit instruction, those are intricately connected. These are not things that three different areas where we're going to go and do work. These are things that, okay, my curricula calls for. We're going to the Gilded Age, and we have to address this question with the Gilded Age. That's the essential question for this particular part of this unit. So now we get a text that treats the Gilded Age. Even as you said, a few pages from a textbook would be completely adequate there. Mm-hmm. And then we explicitly teach students. So that's the third strategic piece you mentioned earlier. We explicitly teach students how to do the reading, how to do the writing. You mentioned note-taking, how to do the discussion. We explicitly teach them how to do these basic foundational literacy skills. So I just want to emphasize that this is a very cohesive picture of how we can improve the effect that we have on students. Mike, I want to ask you this. Teachers are busy. They're stressed out. And so when they hear you saying, we need to increase the quantity, we've hit the quality of these authentic literacy experiences, right? You just explained how do we add quality to those literacy experiences. We teach students explicitly. We model for students how to do the things we want them to do. But, Mike, how do we teachers, we're busy, we're stressed, we feel like there's not enough time ever anywhere. How do we increase the quantity of literacy experiences that we're giving our students?
Well, I just think the big deal is to convert time currently spent on exercises and worksheets and identifying nouns or verbs in a passage or making book jackets, making bookmarks, doing arts and crafts projects, those kinds of activities need to be set aside so that we engage almost exclusively in the most obvious kinds of literacy, and that is reading, some reading aloud with the teacher reading out loud, and maybe occasionally calling on a student to read a couple of sentences to make sure that they're reading along with you, periodically punctuated with opportunities to stop and say, what do you think of what we've been reading in the last page or two? What do you think of this character? Immediately followed by, or punctuated by, and followed by opportunities to write, jot, take some notes, pair up frequently, pair up, talk with the person next to you, and then engage in whole class discussions, followed by perhaps small writing assignments of mere paragraphs, or a couple of paragraphs, and then converting some of that work, not all of it, but some of it, when the time is right, into more full-blown formal essays. That's where the time needs to be spent. And any college professor will tell you that's the kind of stuff that prepares you for both careers and for college.
Well, yeah, and I like that you mentioned this idea that, because when some folks are hearing what you're saying, they're going to say, oh, well, you know, Mike must be one of those people just wants everyone to go to college. So that's why he's saying this. But absolutely correct that the skills required for careers, especially in the 21st century, are literacy intensive. That trend is only increasing. I appreciate you saying that. I also,
sure.
So you mentioned you got into this idea of shorter compositions, one to a few paragraphs, and then eventually more polished essays. So obviously you're advocating that students write more. But Mike, what about all that work that teachers are going to have to grade if we have kids do all this writing? There's no way that we can grade it all. Give us some practical guidance on managing the paper load.
Well, you bet. And the first thing I'd suggest to people is to Google this term, and that would be write more, grade less.
Yes.
I'm almost certain that an unpublished article of mine that cites the work of Stiggins, Marzano, Carol Yeago, and others will pop up and tell you this stuff in detail. But in essence, it's this. I like to ask people if they even have a gut hunch or come across research on how effective it is to red mark an essay, in an exhaustive way. in almost any group of people, I will ask that question, they'll realize they have real misgivings about that, real doubts that that has much impact. Well, they're right. It's enormously time consuming to spend lots of time on each paper, grading, marking, and yet it doesn't have much impact. The faster, more efficient, and way more effective way to become, to ensure that your students become better writers is to, among other things, focus on patterns of strength and weakness amongst whole classrooms and address those so that when you see those patterns, even in your checks for understanding as you walk around during a well-taught lesson, as you see those areas where lots of students have difficulty, and there will be common patterns of weakness in students' writing, you can bet on that.
Right.
Address those to the whole class and not do that painstaking method of writing something in the margin and on every paper in every case where there's a problem or a weakness, but by teaching students, using classroom time to address problems with writing. And number two, there's a few other things you can do too, but these are among my favorites. Teach each aspect of writing, most of the time, one single criteria or trait at a time, so that students are focusing on that one thing. You only have to look for, teach to, and grade for one thing at a time. And so that by the time your lesson is over, that one thing you are trying to get students to master, that one element of good writing, should be learned before you even collect papers, collect any kind of student writing. You shouldn't collect it until you are pretty sure that virtually every student, through multiple steps of an effectively taught lesson, have in fact mastered that lesson. And a lot of the time, you don't even have to collect the papers. You can simply indicate in a column of your grade book that all of the students, or all but just a few who need some extra help, have in fact mastered an element. An element, folks, an element as simple, just to be more concrete, because I do this myself, is teaching students that you have to develop a clear thesis statement, and it's a good idea to introduce it with, this is the one thing I would teach, one thing at a time. I would teach introductory paragraphs by saying, you've got to precede that that thesis statement or argument with some kind of a hook or interesting statement that makes the reader, it grabs their attention, makes them want to keep reading.
Sure.
And a lot of the time, this isn't in every kind of in all writing, but it's a good thing for you to learn to do, is after you've written your thesis or argument, have a statement that outlines, maybe in almost a list form, or with just a little more detail, a quick preview of what the reader will encounter. These are simple ways you can make nice, coherent, interesting, arresting introductory paragraphs. You teach each of those elements one at a time, teach and model them one step at a time. And folks, if we taught in that fashion, you know, we would have in that fashion on a regular basis, we'd have students writing terrific, soundly structured essays by the time they're in the third and fourth grade. Good third and fourth grade writing at those ages and grade levels.
And that is, I think, a great place for us to end. And I will confirm that if you Google "write more, grade less," you'll definitely see Mike's article at the very top on his website. And I have referred to that countless times in my own career, and have pushed countless people to read that, because in every single time that I read it, or somebody that I advise to does it, you see the raised eyebrows, or just the release of tension. I'm picturing a lot of English language arts teachers who are the most knowledgeable people in the world about helping young writers listening to this, who have to guiltily admit that they are doing the highly time-consuming, next to no impact practice of marking all kinds of things. So thank you so much, Mike, for that closing piece. I, again, commend folks to check out the notes of this interview, because there you'll see links to Dr. Smoker's book. Mike, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.
And I hope that you can enjoy some hiking soon, but stay out of that scorching heat that you're currently experiencing.
Will do.
All right.
Thanks much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You bet. Take care, David.
You too.
Well, there you have it. Words straight out of the mouth of Dr. Schmoker himself. I'd love to hear what you think. Use the comments section of this interview to process information, ask further questions, share top takeaways, and anything else that you can think of. I'll see you there. Take care.